Welcome to the deep dive. We're kicking off a pretty big deep dive this time, 10 parts, actually.
Wow.
Yeah, it's all about data, of course. But this time, we're really going deep on how it's changed, you know, over time and how all that impacts the way organizations make decisions. Our guide for this whole thing is a brand new book by Dr. Yaniv Nayor-Nahum.
Okay, yeah.
And today we're diving into chapter one.
Sounds good.
Just think about it. From like ancient cave paintings to cloud computing, data has really shaped how we understand everything, you know, the world, how businesses work, all of that.
Right.
It's a pretty big topic, right?
Yeah, it really is. And what I find fascinating is how Dr. Nayor really highlights the, you know, the increasing value of data.
Yeah.
It's not just a nice to have anymore. It's like
right.
The fuel driving the fourth industrial revolution, you know?
Yeah.
He really emphasizes how mastering data management and governance, that's critical for any organization that wants to like actually unlock that value, stay competitive, you know?
Totally. I was struck by that too. Like his analogy of data to oil, you know, both super valuable resources, but you need the right tools, the right processes, the right people to refine them to get to that potential.
Yeah.
Dr. Nayor starts us off way, way back in time, like with early humans and cave paintings, which it's kind of crazy to think about it, but those were some of the earliest forms of data management, right?
Yeah. I mean, it just goes to show you how fundamental this need is for humans, like to record and share information. That need has just gotten like more sophisticated over time.
Right.
But it's still there, you know? Those cave paintings in Spain, they're like over 64,000 years old.
Wow.
And then that one's in Indonesia, like 45,500 years old. Humans have always been driven to capture and communicate their experiences and observations. It's wild.
So fast forward a few thousand years and we land at the start of the Industrial Revolution.
Okay.
And we meet Semyon Korsakov in 1805.
Yeah.
And he has this brilliant idea for using punch cards to store information.
Uh-huh.
And you won't believe this, but he initially intended it for the textile industry.
Oh, wow.
Isn't that crazy how an innovation from one field can spark massive changes in another totally unrelated one?
Korsakov was definitely ahead of his time.
Right.
It's crazy that the Imperial Academy of Sciences in St. Petersburg, they couldn't see the potential.
Oh, wow.
But I mean, he wasn't the only one. There were all these other brilliant minds around the world working on similar things, like Basil Bouchon, Joseph Marie Jacquard. They both used punch cards for textile weaving.
Wow.
And even Charles Babbage, like the father of the computer, he was exploring ways to mechanize information processing, you know, way back then.
It makes you wonder how many of those ideas, like groundbreaking ideas, were just tossed aside because people couldn't see how they could be used.
Right, yeah.
The book talks about a French telegraph engineer, Jules Carpentier.
Okay.
In the late 1800s, he makes the Mélographe Répétiteur. Which was a device that could record piano music.
Oh, wow.
Using, guess what? Punch cards.
That's amazing.
I know. And then there's his playback device, the Mellotrope. It's really mind-blowing how those early inventions, like, they're almost like foreshadowing the way we store and access digital media today.
Yeah, they totally are.
But sadly, like Korsakov, Carpentier had a hard time getting people to see how awesome his inventions were.
Right.
And it just reminds you that innovation isn't just about making something new. It's also about getting other people to see the value.
Absolutely.
Okay, now here's where things get really interesting. It's the story of Hermann Hollerith and the 1890 U.S. Census. They were facing a data deluge. I mean, can you imagine?
Yeah.
And Hollerith, brilliant engineer, he develops this electromechanical tabulating machine. And it was a game changer.
Hollerith's tabulating machine was revolutionary.
Oh, boy.
I mean, think about it. Punch cards to read, sort, and calculate data.
Yeah.
Tasks that used to take years could now be done in way less time, you know? And what's really wild is that it was just for the census at first, and then it ends up laying the foundation for the entire computer industry.
It's a good word, right?
And his company. Well, eventually it becomes IBM.
Oh, well,
you know, like the name everyone thinks of when they think of computing.
It's amazing how much of a ripple effect his work had.
Yeah.
And those punch cards, like with their precisely placed holes representing data, they became the standard for decades.
Right.
I found it fascinating how IBM kept refining them. You know, eventually they made the 80-column card with rectangular holes in 1928.
It really highlights how important this drive for greater capacity and efficiency is. Every innovation builds upon the last one, pushing the boundaries of what's possible.
And they even use these cards for coding, right?
Oh, yeah.
Programmers would send stacks of these cards to data centers to get them punched and verified.
It's like they were creating physical representations of their programs.
I know.
It really blows my mind when you think about how easy and fast modern programming is now.
I know, right?
Back then, working with data, it was so hands-on. You needed meticulous attention to detail.
Yeah. Talk about a different world.
Right.
And as we needed more and more storage, new innovations came up. So in the 1920s, we see magnetic data storage come onto the scene. Fritz Fluhmer invents magnetic tape for recording sound, and that totally changes things.
That was a major turning point in the whole data journey.
Right.
Magnetic storage, whether it's tapes, hard drives, or even those old floppy disks.
Ooh, yeah.
It totally revolutionized how we capture and keep data. It's like this perfect example of how these totally separate fields can come together and impact each other.
So cool.
Yeah.
And as we started saving more and more data, this idea of being able to get to it from anywhere, that started to take shape.
Yeah.
Dr. J.C.R. Licklider, back in the 1960s, he envisioned an intergalactic computer network.
Wow.
Right? Which, I mean, that's a pretty futuristic concept for back then.
It really is.
But it's that idea of shared data, shared resources, accessible from anywhere.
Yeah.
That really paved the way for what we know as cloud computing today, you know?
Licklider was a visionary. Imagine back then, computing was all about those massive mainframes, you know? And he was already thinking about a world where information could be shared as easily as we turn on a faucet or flip a light switch.
Wow.
It's incredible.
It's amazing. And that brings us to this whole mainframe versus cloud debate, which it's still going on today, right?
Yeah.
So you've got the mainframes, those centralized computing giants.
Uh-huh.
And then cloud computing, which is more distributed.
Right.
It uses the internet to connect you to these remote servers.
Yeah.
It's like the difference between having all your data in a giant library versus having it accessible on your phone anywhere.
What's interesting is how these two approaches kind of developed alongside each other.
Right.
Mainframes were really powerful.
Yeah.
But they were limited in terms of, you know, scalability and how accessible they were. Yeah. Cloud computing came along and offered more flexibility, more affordability.
Yeah.
And it was a total game changer, especially for smaller businesses.
And then Dr. Naynor dives into all the different types of cloud services.
Oh, yeah.
Infrastructure as a service, yeah. Platform as a service, software as a service.
So,
like a tiered system, each one offering a different level of control and responsibility.
Think of it as a spectrum, right? Oh, with IGA, you're in charge of the operating system, the networking, the data. The cloud provider just takes care of the physical stuff, the servers, data centers.
Right.
With Keras, the provider manages even more. They give you a platform to build and run your applications.
Yeah.
And then there's Salas. The provider handles everything, and you just get access to these ready-to-use software applications like email or customer relationship management tools.
Right.
It's really cool.
It's amazing how cloud computing has made those powerful computing resources available to everyone, you know?
Yeah, it really is.
But this is just the beginning. We've covered a lot in this first chapter, but Dr. Naynor's journey through the evolution of data has just started.
Absolutely. In our next deep dive, we'll go into databases, you know, from that hierarchical model all the way to NoSQL. So stick with us as we continue this journey.
It's going
to
be a good one.
So we've talked about how we store all this data, right? But now we got to figure out how to organize it all. Dr. Nahum, he takes us back to the 1960s and this thing called the hierarchical database model.
Yeah, the hierarchical model. When I first learned about that, it reminded me of like files on a computer.
Oh, yeah.
You know, folders within folders. Yeah. That tree-like structure.
That's a great way to think about it.
Yeah.
It's all about these parent-child relationships. Every data record has a parent, and it all goes back to a single root record. This whole thing was pioneered by Charles Bachman with the Integrated Data Store, or IDS.
Okay.
Later on, IBM really pushed it forward with their information management system, IMS. One of their main goals was to separate the application layer from the database layer.
Makes sense.
So developers could just focus on building their apps without getting bogged down in all the complexities of data, you know, storage and retrieval and all that.
Right, right. So it seems like a pretty logical way to structure data, especially when you think about, like, organizational hierarchies, you know. But as with any system, there were some limitations, right?
Exactly. It worked well for simple relationships, but as data got more complex, more interconnected,
yeah.
It started to fall apart. Imagine trying to represent like a social network using a simple tree. It just wouldn't work. You couldn't capture all those dynamic many-to-many relationships.
Right, right. So that's what led to the network database model, right, in the late 60s. Seems like the next logical step.
It was Charles Bachman, again, championing the network model.
Wow, he was busy.
He introduced this idea of many-to-many relationships. So instead of a rigid tree, you have this web of interconnected data points.
Okay.
Much more flexibility. It really took off in the 70s, especially after Code O'Sell formalized the structure.
So we went from just parents and children to this whole web of connections. But I'm guessing that flexibility came with its own set of challenges, right?
You got it. Managing all those relationships, especially as databases got bigger and more complex, that was a real pain.
Maybe.
You needed specialized knowledge, careful planning. Otherwise, you'd have problems with data integrity and retrieval.
Yeah, that makes sense. So then we get to the relational database model, which is kind of the foundation of the data world we know today, right?
Exactly. 1970, Edgar F. Codd, he's a researcher at IBM, publishes this groundbreaking paper. He introduces the relational model, and it was such a simple idea, but incredibly powerful.
Okay.
Organize data into tables with rows and columns. Think of a spreadsheet.
Yeah.
It's that same familiar structure, but for data storage.
Like taking something we use every day and applying it to databases. And that's where SQL comes in.
Structured query language, right?
You got it. SQL. It's the language we use to interact with these relational databases. You define the relationships between those tables, extract the data you need. The beauty of the relational model is its simplicity and efficiency. Searching for data became easier. Stores got streamlined.
Yeah.
It set the stage for relational databases to be adopted everywhere.
Right. And they became the backbone of everything. Customer transactions, inventory management, scientific research.
Pretty much everything.
But then as we get into the 1990s, there's this new challenge, big data. That's right. John Mashey, computer scientist, he coined that term big data to describe these huge, complex data sets that were starting to overwhelm traditional databases.
Right.
It wasn't just about the amount of data. It was also about the different types of data, the speed at which it was being generated, and the sheer difficulty of extracting insights from it all.
So big data wasn't just about, like, more data. It was a fundamental shift in the kind of data and how fast we were getting it.
Yeah. Dr. Naylor breaks it down with this 5 V's framework: variety, volume, velocity, value, veracity.
The 5 V's.
Each one represents a different challenge.
Okay.
We're talking structured data from traditional databases, unstructured data like text documents and social media posts,
yeah.
Semi-structured data like emails, sensor readings. It was all coming from everywhere, super fast. Traditional relational databases, yeah, designed for neat rows and columns. They weren't built for this.
They weren't ready for the influx.
Nope. And that's where NoSQL databases step in.
Okay, NoSQL. Not only SQL.
Yeah.
So new approach, right?
Able to handle those massive data sets, all the different data formats that were becoming the norm.
So instead of trying to fit a square peg in a round hole, NoSQL databases offered a whole new set of tools.
Right. It was a huge shift in the data world. And like, relational databases are built on tables. NoSQL comes in a bunch of different flavors, each one suited for different things.
Okay.
You've got the column-oriented model, great for fast retrieval. The document model, perfect for storing all sorts of data formats. Then there's the key value model, ideal for simple lookups.
Okay.
And the graph model, perfect for mapping those complex relationships we talked about earlier.
So it's like having a toolkit of database models, each one with its own strengths.
Exactly.
Which brings us to data integration.
Mm-hmm.
How do you bring together data from all these different sources with different formats and structures and actually make sense of it all?
Yeah, it's a big challenge. Dr. Naylor really emphasizes recognizing all the different types of conflicts that can pop up when you're trying to integrate data. Like, you might have data in different formats, binary versus decimal, or different systems using different terms for the same thing, a semantic conflict. And then there's data conflict, where the same record gets changed in multiple places.
Oh, yeah. That's a headache.
So it's not just about bringing the data together. It's about making sure it's consistent, accurate, and usable. That's where data management and governance come in. Dr. Nahum has a whole chapter on this stuff, and he's right.
Right.
They're essential if organizations want to use data effectively.
So data management is like the nuts and bolts of how you handle data every day, right?
Yeah, like the processes, technologies, and practices for capturing, storing, organizing, analyzing data.
Okay.
Data governance is more about the policies and controls that ensure data integrity, availability, security, setting the rules for how data is used and protected.
So guidelines for trustworthy data.
Exactly. Dr. Naylor breaks down the types of data that companies typically work with.
Yeah.
unstructured data like text documents, metadata, hierarchical data, transactional data, master data, even reference data.
It's a lot to keep track of.
It is. He also talks about master data management, or MDM, creating a single source of truth for critical business data, the golden record for a customer, a product, anything.
So everyone in the company is using the same information.
Exactly. Consistency and accuracy across the board. But to get there, you need a solid data management strategy.
Right.
The book covers things like data integration, data quality management, data modeling, data storage, and of course, data analytics and reporting. It really shows how important both technical and non-technical skills are for data management.
It's a whole team effort.
It is. He also talks about the importance of data governance in ensuring data quality. He lays out the systematic approach, data profiling to understand your data cleansing to fix errors, and ongoing data quality prevention and maintenance to keep things running smoothly.
Keep it all clean.
Exactly. And he emphasizes clear roles and responsibilities for data ownership, stewardship, accountability, building a culture where everyone understands how important data quality is.
It's about everyone taking ownership.
Yeah, exactly. That's where data maturity models come in. They give companies a framework to assess where they're at with data management and find areas to improve.
Okay, so like a roadmap.
Exactly. Dr. Nahum talks about Gartner's Master Data Management Maturity Model. 6 levels of maturity, from unaware to optimized.
So companies can see where they stand and where they need to go.
Yeah, it's a roadmap for them to become truly data-driven. So we've covered a lot about how data is organized and managed.
It's been a fascinating journey, from simple hierarchical structures to the crazy world of big data and NoSQL.
We've come a long way.
But the big question is, how does all this impact the way businesses make decisions?
That's a great question, and that's what we'll dive into next time. We'll be looking at business process management, decision support systems, and the really exciting world of robotic process automation. So stick with us to see how the data revolution is changing how businesses operate and make those big strategic choices.
Okay, so we spent some time on the history of data storage in organization, but now I really want to get into how this whole data revolution is changing the way businesses make decisions.
Yeah, now we're getting to the heart of it. Dr. Nahum really dives deep into this, starting with the evolution of business process management, or BPM.
When I hear business process management, I immediately think about optimizing workflows, making things more efficient. Is that what we're talking about here?
You nailed it. It's all about analyzing and streamlining the processes that keep a business running. And it's not even a new concept, really. The book takes it way back to the early 1900s, highlighting Frederick Taylor and his 1911 article, The Principles of Scientific Management.
Yeah, I remember learning about Taylor. Wasn't he all about breaking down tasks and standardizing processes?
Exactly. He was a big believer in data-driven decisions and continuous improvement, which are like the cornerstones of modern BPM. The book traces this lineage through different methodologies like the Schoharz cycle, Deming's PDCA cycle, Kaizen, even agile methodologies. It's amazing how these approaches, even though they came from different places, all share that focus on making processes as efficient and effective as possible.
So BPM is about looking at a business as a system of interconnected processes, and then using data analysis and technology to make those processes smoother, faster, more efficient. It's about getting rid of waste and getting the most out of everything.
Exactly. And as technology got better, so did BPM. The book talked about workflow management systems powered by all those advances in computing power. These systems let organizations automate and track complex processes, making things even more efficient and reducing errors. Think about all those repetitive tasks that used to take forever and were so prone to human error. With workflow management systems, a lot of that can be automated, freeing up people to do more strategic, creative work.
So it's a win-win, right? More efficient, happier employees. But Dr. Nahum doesn't stop there. He goes on to decision support systems, or DSS. These systems are all about using data to help managers make smarter decisions.
Right. Decision support systems came from the understanding that decision making, especially at the strategic level, is complicated, and that data can be really helpful. Dr. Nahum highlights 3 key things about DSS. They're supposed to support decision making, not automate it. They're flexible, they can change with the needs of the decision makers, and they use data analysis tools and models to give valuable insights.
So it's like giving managers the information they need to make the best possible decisions, but it's still their judgment and expertise that matters most. It's like having a superpowered research assistant that can gather and analyze data, but the manager is still the one calling the shots.
That's a great way to put it. Dr. Nahum outlines different levels of decision support systems. At the operational level, you have transaction processing systems, or TPS. These capture and process day-to-day transactions, like sales, inventory updates, customer interactions. Then there's management information systems, or MIS, which give tactical managers summaries and reports based on that transactional data. And at the top, the strategic level, you have DSS using more complex models and analysis to support those really tricky decisions. The book does a great job of showing how these systems all work together to give a complete view of the business and support decision-making at every level.
And as you go up those levels, the decisions become less clear-cut, more reliant on interpreting data and using good judgment. It made sense that you would need more sophisticated tools to help with those higher-level decisions.
Absolutely. Dr. Nahum points out a bunch of advantages of DSS. Better decision quality, better communication and collaboration within the organization, lower costs, higher productivity, and even happier customers and employees.
That's a pretty impressive list. But like with any technology, there are some potential downsides.
Yeah, definitely. Dr. Nahum acknowledges those. Implementing these systems can be expensive, and there's always the risk of relying too much on the technology and not enough on human intuition and experience. And then there's the worry about jobs being lost if things aren't handled carefully. It's really important to remember that DSS are tools meant to help people make decisions, not to replace them altogether.
Finding that right balance between human smarts and what technology can do is key. But now Dr. Nahum takes us a step further into the future with robotic process automation, or RPA. This is where things start to feel like they're straight out of a sci-fi movie.
RPA is definitely a game changer. Imagine software robots that can do all those repetitive, rule-based tasks that humans usually handle. Data entry, invoice processing, even some customer service stuff.
Wait, so robots doing our jobs? That's a little scary, but also kind of awesome.
It's not about robots taking over. It's about giving humans more time to do the things that require creativity, problem solving, and critical thinking. RPA is all about automating the boring stuff so we can focus on what we do best.
So it's more about expanding our abilities, not getting rid of us.
Precisely. Dr. Nahum traces the development of RPA all the way back to screen scraping software in the 1990s, and now we have these sophisticated platforms that can handle complex processes, work with multiple systems, and even learn and adapt as they go. The book talks about several benefits of RPA: higher productivity, fewer errors, better compliance, more scalability, and even happier employees. Imagine not having to spend hours on boring data entry. Wouldn't that be amazing?
I'm sold. But I'm guessing there are challenges with implementing RPA too, right?
You bet. Integrating RPA with existing systems, especially older ones, can be a headache. Careful planning and governance are super important to make sure these robots are working the right way, ethically. And yeah, the possibility of jobs being lost is a real concern that needs to be addressed head on. Dr. Nahum emphasizes that successful RPA implementation means thinking about the technical side and the human side.
It's a good reminder that technology should be there to help us, not the other way around. And then Dr. Nahum takes us even further, talking about intelligent automation, or IA. It's like RPA, but with a super-powered brain.
IA is where artificial intelligence comes in. We're talking about systems that can learn, adapt, and even make decisions on their own, using things like machine learning, natural language processing, and computer vision. It's the next level of automation, and it has the potential to totally change every industry.
It's exciting and a little intimidating to think about what IA could do and what challenges it could bring. But that's probably a conversation for another deep dive, maybe when we get to the end of Dr. Nahum's book.
Yeah, for sure. We've covered so much in this first chapter, exploring the evolution of data and how it's impacting the way organizations make decisions. From ancient cave paintings to cutting-edge IA, it's been a wild ride.
Dr. Nahum's book is such a great overview of this data revolution. And this is just the beginning of our exploration. We're going to keep digging into these ideas in future episodes, looking at the ethics of AI, what's going to happen with data privacy, and a whole lot more.
So stick around, data fans. This deep dive into the world of data is far from over.
See you next time.